Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
They'll fill the ball up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome back to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff.
McClure.
You can say that again if you'd like.
Yes, we can say McClure multiple times if you would like. This is The Personal Wealth Coach, where we will feed you calming advice, even when inappropriate. we've got to give some disclosures before we tell you more about who we are, but wait a minute, disclosures are telling you more about who we are. The Personal Wealth Coach is the name of this program. It's the name of this podcast, this radio program, and sometimes this recording that's used to put babies to sleep. I have heard it being used that way, and I have been reported to that our voices are good for putting babies to sleep.
So, car drivers.
Or truck drivers late at night. So this is our first disclosure. If you are operating heavy machinery, please stop and or change the channel. Next disclosure, we are both bald. All right, if you're still with us at this point, we also have beards. Okay, you're still with us. And we are both the principals at another organization, also called the Personal Wealth Coach, that's registered with the SEC to give fiduciary investment advice, which we cannot do on the air. Because not privacy concerns, and how do we customize it to each of you that are listening when nobody's listening? So it'd be like advice to no one, but that anyone could listen to if they wanted to. So obviously, we can't give fiduciary advice on the air. And just because we're registered with the SEC doesn't mean that they like us. It doesn't mean that they gave us some kind of a gold star somewhere or a lollipop. In fact, they regulate us, and if we tried to give them a gold star or a lollipop, we might get in trouble for bribery or something. So we have to keep that not occurring. So just because we're registered with them doesn't give any sort of authority to us. There. You want to do the next disclosure?
I was really impressed with that last one there.
I added lollipops to it, so that's always makes things better.
You've given all the good stuff. We don't pay for this radio program, nor does the station pay us to do the radio program. We do advertise on KTEM for the radio program, but then so do they.
Yes.
Let's see. And the information we present on this educational radio program, which is not investment advice, has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of said information.
Yes. So the only warranty or guarantee is to the inaccuracy of incomplete and unsaid information.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which basically means nothing we're about to say for the next 2 hours is of any worth whatsoever.
Unless you deem it so.
Oh, well, you can deem, yes.
Yes, anyone's allowed to deem. We're bringing the word deem back. It is not used enough in common parlance.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, if you deem it once and then you go back and deem it again, you would be redeeming it.
That's true. But if you deem on something, it's like a demon.
You got a point there.
Can you redeem a demon?
That is a deep theological question.
Theological.
How many demons can dance on a redemption? Well, it's time for the market. We've seen a lot of this recently, and it's one of those things that bears looking at over a little longer period of time. But the market gnashed its teeth, went up, went down, went up, went down, went into panic, went into exaltation, went into this and that and the other during the week, and wound up pretty much where it started the week. The S&P 500 stock index, SPX. And why do I say SPX? Well, there is also an SPY.
Why? Exactly.
Yeah, well, there's a specific definition for SPX, and you want to look it up, you'll find out why I say SPX. Anyway, it dropped 0.69% for the week, closing at 3965.34. Now, let's give the statistics.
The statistics?
It is down. If it had only dropped this much from the beginning of the year, we wouldn't have a bear market. We would technically just be in a correction. It's down 16.8% from its high at the beginning of the year. It's down 15.59% from this time last year, but it is up 10% since October 12th, 10.7% to be exact. And if you go back to the March of 2020, which was quite recent, at least in my experience, it's up an astonishing 77.23%. If you look back 3 years to just before the pandemic, just before everything went kind of crazy, it's up 28% from 3 years ago. So whether the market is up or down right now is very much dependent upon your time horizon. It's either up, if you have a longer time horizon, and if you're an investor, that's a very good idea as opposed to a speculator, then you have some, probably seeing some significant gains if you're invested in anything that is in equities in the United States. The other index we follow, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, which is a different, most of those stocks in that index are in the S&P 500, but they're down at the lower sized end, and they're value stocks as opposed to the growth stocks that dominate the S&P 500. So it's another index about a part of the market. It fell 0.9% for the week, closed at 2387.06, but is only down about 8% from its high point in January and 6.5% from this time last year. We say that because where you're invested in the stock market and in equities in the United States will make a big difference about whether your what condition your portfolio is in over a given period of time. The S&P 500 is not the know-all, end-all. I know a lot of people invest in S&P 500 index funds and think they're cool. I could argue with that. But it isn't the whole thing. It isn't the whole picture, and there's different ways to approaching that. The other side of the market, the bond side of the market, the benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is a strong indicator of what 10-year interest rates are. It is the baseline. It actually ended the week at 3.82%, the yield, which is exactly where it ended last week, which is sort of fascinating. It bobbed around too, but came right back to where it started. The 2-year note yields 4.51%. Why do I bring that up? Because traditionally, although some economists will definitely argue with this, and so do members of the Fed, traditionally, the difference between the two-year note and the 10-year note mark whether the yield curve for treasuries is inverted. And if the 2-year note is yielding higher than the 10-year note, and it is at 4.51 versus 3.82, that means the yield curve is inverted. And in the majority of cases where the yield curve has been inverted as much as it is right now, sometime within the next 18 months or so, the United States had a recession. There are people who are arguing, and I think very persuasively, that it is different this time. There's a lot of things going on right now that certainly have not gone on for half a century. And we're not even sure they happened half a century ago, because half a century ago, we weren't keeping that good of records. So we may or may not have a recession coming in this one, which is, I'm sure, very useful to you.
Yes, it's very, very indicative of the fact that we may or may not have something occurring. Thank you for number, all the surety that you're giving us here.
the other number we're following, the price per barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil. Well, why do we do that? Because this is a strong indicator of what's going on in the economy, although it's a much stronger indicator, like interest rates, when only one thing is changing.
Yes.
When you only have multiple inputs changing, then it becomes a very confusing number. The benchmark fell about 10% for the week. The price of oil dropped 10% over the last week. It's at $80.23. Now, to put that in perspective, it was over $120 a barrel in June. And a little over a year ago, people had to pay $37 to get somebody to take a barrel away from them. The price of oil has been going all over the place. The price of gasoline, the price of diesel. Why is that?
Just a time out a second. Your age is coming into appearance again. It was almost 2 years ago now.
Okay, 2 years ago. I'm sorry.
Yeah, a little over a year. When you say
2 years.
You know, a couple of years ago when Enron collapsed. You know, we've been around in the business a long time. We lose track of time easily.
You're right. 2 years ago, people were paying people to take oil away from them. Why is this going on? Well, there's two elements in any price: supply and demand. And you can argue about a lot of other things, but those are the big ones. the supply of oil, when it was $120 a barrel, had been cut dramatically because one of the major oil producers in the world, Russia, had been effectively embargoed, at least part of its oil supply had been embargoed. And it was also saying, we're not going to give oil to certain people. And this is continuing apace. This is continuing to happen.
Yeah. And this is on top of existing embargoes on Iran and Venezuela.
Right.
So that there's a large percentage of the supply has been limited because the people that were supplying it, they're not necessarily nice people, probably people we shouldn't be buying from. Okay.
Right. We shouldn't be giving them money. But on the other side, the demand has fallen, which means despite the fact there's a restriction in supply, the price of oil has fallen recently over the last several months because probably the biggest single factor is that China's economy is slowing dramatically and they are buying less oil. And they are the second biggest user of oil in the world as a nation, an economy. The United States is number one, but we have our own oil. The Chinese are number two and they don't have their own oil in any significant amount. So as they have a falling demand for oil, the price tends to come down. And I'm sure, by the way, that's very frustrating to the Russians at this point because the Russians were rejoicing in black marketing their oil at high price around the embargoes. They really enjoyed the high price of oil, and the fact that the price of oil has fallen pretty dramatically, it is certainly hurting their economy. Russia's economy is down very significantly. It's really hard to tell because they're not exactly allowing us to measure their economy carefully, but it is, they're in a pretty severe recession right now and going downhill at a high rate of speed. The Chinese, it's really hard to tell what's going on in China, however, by looking at the satellite photographs of who's got their lights on, measuring import, the number of ships that are carrying, for example, oil into Chinese ports, which can be seen through satellites. The estimates are that their economy is in pretty poor shape and slipping downhill too. Now, of course, since we're talking about international economies, it's important to note that the European Union is slipping into recession at 10% inflation officially year over year. And the United Kingdom is almost certainly already in a pretty severe recession with 11.1% inflation being reported in the United Kingdom. All in all, this is a pretty good place to be. That's the market.
Agreed. We have talked in the past about how it's harder and harder to trust what's coming out of China when they talk about what's happening in their economy. We've had a series of American companies that are auditing and giving credit ratings and so on there, and it's been very nice to be able to fall back on them. Moody's is closing its consulting business in China report this week. So what we have said throughout the last 2 years about, you know, we can't trust the same way we did what was coming from China. 5 years ago, we looked at their data and while it had some discrepancies, it wasn't bad. And we had lots of sources of data. Now we have the Chinese government as the only source of data for much of what's happening there. So that's a little scary. As you said just a minute ago, it's nice to live where we live, not to have to worry about that. That we at least know what companies are making money and losing money. We have a strange occurrence this week. We have no question from Inquisitor John. Mm. This is an interesting phenomenon. We're saying this on the air because he's such a consistent fellow. So I hope he's okay. And thank you very much for all of the questions you've asked in the past. Please don't make this sound like or hear this as a complaint. We really appreciate the questions you've had. We have a lot to talk about this week. A lot to talk about.
We got one subject we could talk about for 2 hours.
Well, yeah, we probably have more than one subject we can talk about for 2 hours. I want to talk about the headline of every major publication that I've been able to find today, because if it's the headline everywhere, people, I'm sure, are curious about it. And that's about what happened with FTX, the crypto exchange that turned into a massive ordeal so far. We have headlines on as I said, about every major publication. Most of them are salacious. Most of the stories, even the stories in places like The Economist and The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times, places that we would normally expect hard-nosed statistical reports to come out. Instead, they're focusing on, here's the headline of The Wall Street Journal, they live together. They work together. They lost billions together. Inside Sam Bankman-Fried's doomed FTX empire, next week on Lifetime. I added the next week on Lifetime. But that's
by the way, he's popularly known as SBF.
Yes, SBF. Though he's unpopular now, so he may have that changed.
Well, I think the things that he's known as right now by a lot of people, probably we shouldn't say on the radio.
Yes, there are a lot of bad words being said about him. So the salaciousness of many of these headlines are part of why they're headlines. It's part of why they're leading stories, is because everybody wants to hear about these horrible people who were doing horrible things. And as sad as I am to say this, and I prick the salaciousness bubble and say, these were some pretty ignorant, intelligent people that jumped into this and were given so many accolades and credits for early successes that they didn't do things like hire accountants, audit their own books, balance the checkbook, determine whose money was whose before spending it. Things like that, which you can point at and say, how nefarious. And I just look at it and say, yeah, it was nefarious in an ignorant way. They had absolutely no training running a business, and people were trusting them with tens of billions of dollars. And this is facepalm moment. You can all jump up and down about the salaciousness of what was going on and how didn't people know. Please go back and listen to our radio program for the past 3 years. Every time we talk about crypto, and we've specifically talked about FTX and the people in charge there and how they're just kind of basically printing stuff and calling it a currency. When, you know, at least cryptocurrency, there's like a half-hearted wave toward you're getting a reward for solving a puzzle for encrypting a ledger book block. They didn't even do that wave at Binance and Coinbase and crypto.com. They just say, all right, we've just made some more. Here you go. No puzzle or anything else, and people were buying them. So it's like if you had a Beanie Baby that cost you absolutely nothing to make, and people would still collect it. But wait, not even have a Beanie Baby. Let's just talk about the idea of a Beanie Baby represented by these numbers online. And that's what people were buying, because they all agreed at that point that they were worth something. And you've said this before the radio program began. Man, this keeps happening. It happens so regularly. It's just mind-boggling, except that it's so regular, and anybody that studies history will see people find something they think they can convince the world is valuable and then sell it. And then eventually the world realizes it's not valuable and it becomes worthless. And everybody turns to the person that sold it and says, oh, how horrible. And the person that was selling it was saying, what? You guys bought it?
Well, you know, at least if you had a kid and you bought Beanie Babies, or you had some Beanie Babies.
You had something.
The kid could play with the Beanie Babies.
Yeah.
With cryptocurrency, I know that if you've seen the pictures in the newspaper, in the media, or wherever, it shows a coin for a Bitcoin or something. There is no coin. There is nothing there. There is a digital encrypted number that you can't see.
Right. Well, and the thing is, that's true when you log into your bank account. You can't see the dollars behind the numbers that are your bank. But it's backed by...
I can go to the bank and get the dollars, yeah, and I can go buy something with
them. It's backed by the bank, and the bank is hopefully backed by some places like the Federal Reserve and the FDIC, and have rules that they have to follow. And you do have the ability to go and say, hey, I want to replace this with another one just like it because it's damaged somehow. If your cryptocurrency, somebody gets a peek at its key, it's worthless. And you can't get it replaced because somebody looked at it.
And the other thing is, and I think this is in my discussions with crypto believers, they keep coming back to the fact it's going to be the new currency. No, I don't often say unambiguously without the hedging or anything else, yes or no about something, but I'm going to say no. Something that can drop 74% in a very short period of time will never be a currency. It'll never be used to buy and sell things except maybe incidentally. I mean, Elon Musk made an effort. I started to say Elon Trump, and I have no idea what it came out of. Elon Musk made an effort to allow people to buy Teslas with cryptocurrency, Bitcoin specifically, and he dropped it rather quickly. And the reason is Bitcoin dropped, and they had set a price for the Teslas in Bitcoin, and some people bought Bitcoins for a very substantial discount because the value of Bitcoins dropped dramatically. And he said, stop that immediately. As a matter of fact, it's fascinating. Even SBF, the guy who headed up FTX, boy, we're using a lot of letters here, liquidated a bunch of cryptocurrency, turned it into dollars in order to use it, $300 million.
We actually don't know what he did with that. He could have gone and bought crypto with it. There's no knowing what he did with the $300
million. But he converted it to dollars first.
Well, that's what it was raised in. So when he raised the money, it came in as dollars. He could have doubled down on his own portfolio. We don't know.
The story I read said it came in, converted it to crypto, and promptly converted it back into dollars and took it. But that's...
We know he took it,
there's so
but we
much
don't,
we
know.
Don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much we don't know.
And since he took it in the Bahamas and not in the United States, the question is he due income tax in the United States on money that he took that... A tremendous amount of money because they made a very major mistake, and that's something we want to talk about.
Right.
Because you could be making the same mistake right now, and that's the key.
And it doesn't have to be a big headline company or a big new fad company. It's just a company that's not audited, that doesn't...
Well, even
you can't
if, even
trust
if it is
their
audited,
books.
Even if it is audited and you can trust their books, Enron was audited.
Right, and the auditors were on board.
Well, they were doing something that was completely legal and appropriate under generally accepted accounting rules.
Until we changed them saying, hey, that's not appropriate.
Right, but you don't know. There's basically, and we said this in the newsletter, and I think if you don't hear anything else, if you're listening, if you remember this, if you're going to pool your money, and pooling money is when you, for instance, put money in the bank, you pooled your money with the other depositors. If you're going to pool your money, when you put money in a mutual fund, you're pooling money with other depositors. That pool is by definition at risk. So there needs to be something backing that pool of money, backing the people who are managing the money. There needs to be a law, a federal law, or a federal regulator, or preferably both, or a federal agency that has been chartered by the federal government that provides insurance on that money, something that causes regulation and some form of legal backing to the values in there. Otherwise, they could disappear in a moment, which is what happened with Madoff, which is what happened with Enron, which is what happened in a lot of other places with Stanford. We've forgotten about Stanford pretty much.
He was the second largest Ponzi scheme ever. So why would we remember him with such folks as Madoff, who was first? Happened at the same time, but if Madoff hadn't been caught then, Stanford would be the name everybody remembered.
And there's advertisements I see on a regular basis for if you have $500,000 or more, send it to us and we'll manage it for you. If you investigate things like that and you dig in to say, once I give you my $500,000, what happens if you take it and run? What happens if you go bankrupt? Who is auditing you? Who, you have some kind of insurance on my $500,000 that I give you? So that if you go under, my money doesn't go under with you. That's the kind of question that it is very, very important to always ask. There is a custodian someplace. Somebody is taking your money and they promise to do something with it. Okay. Who's regulating that somebody? Who's auditing that somebody? And is that somebody got some form of guarantee under the law? Not company, yeah, we guarantee your money. Okay, but who guarantees you? It's crucial to understand. And at the bottom line, and this is just my very sincere personal opinion, either the federal government or at the very least a state government, which is potentially questionable, needs to back wherever your money is pooled and back it explicitly, so that if something happens and the institution where you have put your money suddenly is found to be fraudulent or goes under, that your money gets replaced. And I know that sounds old-fashioned, it sounds ridiculous, but I've sure seen a lot of people over the years who pool their money with other people to do something and found out that it was all or mostly gone suddenly after thinking it was completely secure. One that we've forgotten about, and I'm probably going to be unpopular for mentioning this, but I'm used to being unpopular. Back the last time we saw interest rates go up dramatically, a whole series of life insurance companies who had issued high interest rate, relatively speaking to the economy at the time, promises on life insurance cash value and on annuities started going plump, plump, plump right after another.
What does that mean when they do plump, plump, plump?
That's declared insolvent.
Aha.
They were declared insolvent and seized by the state regulators. See, they're regulated by the states, but they were seized. Some of those cases, people found out rather quickly they only got back 20 or 30 or 40 cents on every dollar they had put in there. In other cases, it took them 20 years and more before they were informed that they would only get back a small percentage of what they had in what they had invested in and saved there. And a lot of those were in retirement plans. And you say, how could such a thing happen? And I've had insurance agents say, that's not possible. It'll never happen. Well, it did. And the one of the advantages or disadvantages that I have for having been in this business more than 40 years is I remember when it did happen and the people coming in to see me at the time who said, I need to do something else with the little money I have left. And it's not something that's taught in the schools. It's not something that's you have to dig to figure out whether there's anybody or any law or anything else backing where you put your money. We do that. But I can tell you unambiguously, it is hard work to try to figure that, to try to find that answer. In some cases, in some cases, you dig and dig and dig and you find out, nope, there's nothing backing that money at all. If that company goes under, just say bye-bye to your money. But it's important. And I know it's been a long time since we've had something other than a cryptocurrency major failure. But this is what happens. We go for a long period of time without these major failures, without these major bankruptcies that take a lot of money from a lot of people. And then they start happening again because we forgot about them. There was a move long ago, 30, 40 years ago, to have the federal government regulate, actually, there's been several of these along the way, regulate and back insurance companies that offered guaranteed annuities and guaranteed this is and that's and the other. And it was effectively smashed and put down. And so we didn't get it. And so it is really seriously, if you've got your money locked up in an institution someplace, whatever that institution is, it is up to you, the investor, the saver, to ensure that there is adequate protection under the law, not from some nebulous guarantee fund, but adequate protection. So if that company goes under, your money doesn't go with it. And that's my soapbox. Thank you.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about the housing market, because there's a series of pieces of news. People are kind of laying off on the concepts behind it and kind of saying, of course, the housing market's down a little bit. But the Mortgage Bankers Association just came out with some statistics this week on Thursday. And the statistic is a big one. Applications for new home purchases decreased 28.6% compared to a year ago. That's really big. Now, when we look at some of the other statistics that are out there about how many sales are up or down, that's more of a lagging indicator because people apply for the mortgage generally before they make the offer. Existing homes are down about 10.6% in sales versus a year ago. And so if new applications for mortgages are down 28%, that's rounded down, then that means next month's numbers from the different folks out there are going to be scary. There's going to be big, big drops in the number of sales. And just keep that in mind. We're going into, we're now in November. December is the month with the least likelihood of selling a house. So if you're in the market and you've been wanting to buy a house and then interest rates started climbing up and you're used to looking over at a 3%, and now we're not at 3% anymore, there's some mildly good news there. According to Freddie Mac, the average, so this isn't somebody of highest credit, but the average 30-year fixed rate mortgage is at 6.6% right now. So it's not an ever-ending climb upward. It's likely to go up again. But with these other numbers, it's quite possible that we're going to see a downward trending price for houses for the next few months. Now, don't expect that to last forever because we still don't have enough houses. And there's some other craziness happening in the world, but this kind of defines part of the reason why we've got overpricing. In Austin, Round Rock, 8.3% of homeowners in the area bought their home in the last year. Just think about that in a normal neighborhood. If one out of every 10, roughly, people were new move-ins, that's what we're seeing in the entire Austin Round Rock area. That's new homes purchases. Now, we didn't get an 8.3% increase in population during the same time period. It was like a 2.5%, which is a very massive growth rate compared to other areas. So what is that? Well, people are caught up in the frenzy and they're buying and selling from each other. That's really indicative of overprice. When somebody's selling a house and buying a new house at the rate of almost 1 out of 10 people. And there's some areas where, like in St. George, Utah, 12% of the population. In Cheyenne, Wyoming, 14% of the people have purchased their house in the last year. So that kind of concept where people are purchasing houses at that rate meant that the interest rates were incredibly low. So we had this big boom, which bid the house prices way, way, way up. And now we're seeing the opposite end of that. And that means that there are going to be people that have to really majorly lower the prices that they're charging in the next few months. When we get back to June again and people are moving for jobs, there's going to be a lot of hard decisions being made and we may see prices come back up and house purchases coming back up. Because once again, bottom line, we don't have as many houses as we have people wanting houses, and we're not building houses right now. It's basically come to a screeching halt because of mortgages. So that the real estate market is weird right now. Too expensive to buy, not enough of them, and that's usually reverse. When things get too expensive to buy, people start producing them in mass. Well, we're not seeing that because the labor shortage is too high. So as soon as we got more people on construction duty, prices would come way, way down. So this all comes back to supply and demand again. We don't have enough people to make houses. Those of us that are making houses can't make a house and try to sell it for the price that we have to charge because the expense that goes into the labor and to the equipment means the price is high. The interest rates being high means that people can't afford what we have too few of. So expect more people to get into construction in the near future. In fact, we're seeing layoffs across tech. Don't be surprised if they go pick up a circular saw. That would be interesting. Twitter employee looks for meditation room and construction project. Still looking three weeks later. This is really stressful cutting all these boards. Sorry, I went a little facetious there at the end.
Actually, there's a bit of information. What we've seen is the applications for new unemployment insurance, which is theoretically an indicator of layoffs in the United States, not rise, despite the fact we've seen more people laid off from tech companies than the total number of people that show up on the new unemployment applications.
And the reason is
why
because
is that?
They haven't hit the numbers yet.
Well, it's not that they haven't hit the numbers. They're going straight into other jobs.
Yeah,
there's so much demand in Silicon Valley and the places where Twitter and other and the other places where people are getting laid off. There is so much demand for people with technical expertise, with the expertise that these people have, that they're not going on unemployment because they're going straight into a new job. Often, this is interesting, with a raise.
Right.
So that's working out well for them.
So the net is that we're still creating more jobs, even though we're seeing. Now, that is likely to reverse over the coming months as the interest rates at the Federal Reserve get raised more. And it looks like we have a consensus on that, by the way, of another half point raise at the next meeting. I'm hearing it from just about every speech from a Federal Reserve governor. So it's likely, just like all the other raises, that they're telling us what they're going to do. But in the meantime, we've got to play some commercials. This is a for-profit program, at least at the studio side. We don't get paid. So we're going to play some commercials, and on the other end, we'll be back. But if you'd like to join the conversation while we're out, the email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey, Charlie, or the Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
All right. We've got a lot more to talk about this week. Quick update. You know, this is one of those things that we kind of touched on over downturns in the past and haven't really talked about now. Rail car traffic and truck counts. These are, for us, very leading indicators, are running at pre-pandemic levels. So generally speaking, this is true almost every year. When you get into the November timeframe, you see the rail car traffic drop. It seems backwards, but that's not how toys are shipped and electronics are shipped very often. Usually they're shipping bulk items and things that are not fragile on the trains, where the trucks are used to ship the other things. So we usually see a drop in rail car traffic about this time of year, and we're seeing it. We are seeing an uptick in truck traffic. saying that. Those are all things that are supposed to be normal this time of year. First Trust has issued a whole bunch of stuff on from Box Office Mojo on what kind of traffic they're seeing for box office receipts, movies and such. We are back to pre-pandemic levels. And people, I know a lot of people are saying, well, weren't we already back to pre-pandemic levels recently? We really haven't been. Even in the massive push to get back out after the pandemic, we've kind of hovered below the pre-pandemic levels for 2022. We're right up there with them now. So steel production, way back up to where it was pre-pandemic. Hotel occupancy back to pre-pandemic levels. Open table state of the restaurant industry. This is from Open Table. We're back to pre-pandemic levels. TSA checkpoint data, pre-pandemic levels. So when we're looking at the effect of the pandemic on the major service and hospitality sectors of our economy, we're still seeing an impact because of the displacement of workers, and the prices are up at these places because they had to hire people when there weren't enough people to hire because they laid people off. But we're utilizing their services at the same level that we were pre-pandemic, which is, from my perspective, that means we're at full recovery from the lockdown. And we've used the word recession when we're talking about the March 2020 event that led into April. It kind of spanned the last half of March and most of April, and that everyone, you know, that was labeled a recession. We should call it something different. I don't know what to call that, but just calling it a recession doesn't make sense. I mean, it's not a traffic jam that caused you to be late to work this time. Nobody was on the road. You didn't go to work because work didn't, period. It just wasn't. I don't know what to call that, a lockdown, a freeze, but to compare it to what we might experience next year in a coming recession, or what we experienced in 2008 or in 1996 or 94 or any of the other times we had recessions, it doesn't look the same. So yes, the economy receded. It did not grow. It shrank during that time period, but it is a weird one. And when we talk about the future, people often ask us what our outlook is for a recession coming up. We talk about all the leading indicators. Every one of them right now is down. That means that we've never had a period where every leading indicator was down, that we didn't get a recession. And we're still saying 60, 70% for the next 18 months that we have a recession.
I'm saying 50-50.
Well, 50-50 in the next 12 months, I would agree with. I'm saying 60, 70%. Well, why is that? Why is it we're saying this? Because between the Great Recession in 2008 to what happened in the pandemic in 2020, we went 12 years without a recession. It was weird. Prior to that, before the Great Recession, the entire century before it, we averaged a recession every 4 years. It was a normal part of life. They just round around, get rid of all the companies that were overinflating themselves, knock them out. We just need to clean them out of the system. We may have gotten used to not doing that. And it's weird because right now, if we were using the definitions that we used in the 1990s, for instance, we just came out of a recession right now because we had 2 quarters of shrinkage, negative growth in the GDP. Now, it doesn't make sense to call that a recession because we technically had growth in profitability across all areas. We just also had an inventory buildup. It's weird. Definitions are strange. And who gets to decide if we're in a recession or coming out of a recession? So why I say 60, 70%? Because We don't even know what to call a recession anymore. We don't know what to call the recession in 2020. We don't know what the definition that they're going to use for the next recession is.
We were in a period of relative stability for a long time in the United States economy. And yes, during that period of time, some very, very fine definitions were made, very nuanced definitions of things like recessions. When we entered into a period of instability, which we have been in basically since the great recession, and it was compounded dramatically by the pandemic, and is further compounded by the war in Ukraine and the weirdness that's going on in China, which is still part of the pandemic, those very fine nuanced definitions don't work very well anymore. They wouldn't have worked very well prior to when they were set up, and they're not working very well now. When everybody, not everybody, but when the vast majority of people in the United States are experiencing growth in their income, businesses are experiencing growth
above inflation.
Good growth going on in the United States, but the GDP is negative for two quarters. Why was the GDP negative for two quarters? Primarily because of imports and exports, because we were importing a lot of stuff. We were buying a lot of stuff, which means that retailers in the United States and even wholesalers in the United States were making a lot of money. So we subtracted that from the GDP because we look at imports as a negative, which we, Jake and I, have been railing against for years. This is silly. This is silly. Imports and exports don't have anything to do with whether or not we're having a recession.
They don't have anything to do with profitability. If you're importing from your own company, if Ford is importing a part from a Ford manufacturer owned by Ford, all the parts owned by Ford, bringing them into the country should not be a negative on their profit. No trade occurred there. But we still refer to it that way in the GDP.
It's a negative. It's not a negative on Ford's profit.
No,
it's negative on the gross domestic product of the United States, which is in essence the United States profit. The whole thing needs to be overhauled. But politically, that is going to be a really, really, really difficult and maybe impossible thing.
Yeah. So when we're talking about recession and the likelihood, even in here, we've got all the leading indicators saying yes, and us saying, well, maybe. We don't know what to call it anymore. In a traditional sense, I would put it at a 90% chance that either we were just in a recession or are about to be at one. In a reality of where we are in the world of profitability and so on, we're in great shape, which is really weird from an economics perspective. We're out of time for this hour. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give investment advice, portfolio management at a fiduciary basis for people of relatively high net worth. Locally, we have voicemail at
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletter there. You can sign up for it. And get it every Friday. You can listen to our podcasts or radio programs going way back. You can find our podcasts anywhere they're available. We have a contact form there, or you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.